Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Thursday, October 7th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hello, Melody, and happy chocolate-covered pretzel day. Can you believe that?
I mean, who comes up with all these days?
In the midst of all the zaniness in this world, we get to celebrate chocolate-covered pretzels. And actually, I had too many ones yesterday at my sister's house. So,
well, you know, it's. I mean, what do these people do all day?
You know,
who are these people?
There, I am sure that there is a department in Hallmark that hires, well, they might not even pay these people, but I'm sure that there are a couple of youngsters that have sat around, surfed the internet, and figured out what's not being celebrated and what could be. Or maybe it's the trade associations. Who knows who's doing it, but someone is.
Well, Dave, in today's world, I don't know of anybody who does anything for nothing.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Whether it be from an employer or from a government check. But anyway, let's go ahead and get to the gold prices today. We see gold. Let me refresh my screen to make sure there weren't any change in the New York spot price after market. We got 59 minutes left. $1,756, down $7. Silver's down 5 pennies at $22.68. Platinum was down 5, $987. Palladium was up over 4%, $76, $2,054. The USDX today was down 0.03 at 94.19. Crude oil up another 1.37, $78.80. And everyone is cheering. Yay! They all caved. McConnell caved. And as we said, they would. It's so funny. They're just a bunch of idiots. But anyway, we have the Dow rose 337 points at 34,754. The S&P was up 36 at 4,399. The NASDAQ was up 152, 14,654. European markets were all positive on that note. Asia was positive. The 10-year yield, positive, 1.569. Oh, what a world that we live. Woo-hoo, we're all out of the woods. And because they raised that, they made us some kind of a deal. So we'll be talking about that. Why don't we just go ahead and do that first? You know, Schumer, he announced this morning that they reached a short-term debt ceiling increase after hours of discussion with his GOP counterpart, Mitch McConnell. You know, Mitch McConnell is such a dweeb. Is that what you call him? Anyway, the agreement allows the debt limit to increase by $480 billion, a sum the Treasury Department estimates will allow it to pay its bills until December 3rd. The current national debt is about $28 trillion, as they tell us, and would be permitted to rise to roughly $28.8 trillion under this deal. Republicans and Democrats have been at odds. Of course, we know this. It's been on theatrics as usual when it comes to the debt ceiling. And, you know, was this the time the U.S. was going to default? I didn't think so. Many did, but you never know. And it certainly didn't bother the markets at all. And so anyway, Dave, it is what it is. And, you know, we've been down this road I don't know how many times. But eventually the side that needs to concede does.
Dear loyal listener, mark my words. Melody and I, and Butch to boot, will be talking about this topic probably in the week leading up to December 3rd, because I suspect at that time, by, you know, at around that time, there will be no new deal. Now, December 3rd, I mean, that's when the I think the continuing resolution funding runs out, too. So it looks as though, you know, we'll have debate about both issues, keeping the government running for the rest of fiscal year 2022 till next September, or some other point in between. And when God's name they'll do about the debt ceiling by then, who the heck knows? It's just pretty amazing. We'll be talking about this, the third segment, in a lot more detail, Melody. Namely, this very quirky, bizarre, gimmicky notion of a little platinum coin being the answer to this policy dilemma. Now, I can virtually assure you, although there may be some growing interest, not necessarily support, but interest in the topic, because even though it's not new, it's been around for 8 years, you know, people are starting to talk about it. Sort of like, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures, ridiculous times call for ridiculous measures, maybe. It ain't a good idea, but we'll talk more about it later in the program.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about it, you know, and it's like, you know, it isn't the first time they waved around a $1 trillion platinum coin. They did this, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, maybe even longer.
Lost track of time. 2013.
I think there was 2011 for sure. Yeah, so I mean, it is just, you know, ridiculous. And I don't even know why they even bother. I mean, like what I said, could you only imagine what the after effects would be if they did that? I mean, it's ludicrous. But anyway, one thing that came out today, well, since we're talking about debt, why don't we just go into the global debt levels. Now, this is just adding debt upon debt upon debt. Could reach 260%. Of GDP by year end. Though low interest rates means the ability to service, and this was all reported by the S&P Global Ratings. So as long as they have low interest rates, it's manageable.
Hmm.
Now, I mean, that's what we saw when Trump was in office. We saw those rates rise, and it wasn't for the consumer out there. I mean, the consumer out there is going to buy anything as long as the credit will be given to them. He'll buy anything. But these corporate debts, they can't service it, even government. And, you know, everybody talks about all the additional pile on debt that was necessary during the shutdowns. And, Vera Chaplin, she's, the credit ratings at S&P Global Ratings, she's the managing director and lead analytical manager. She added that the higher leverage and weakened credit metrics amid the recovery is going to trigger more defaults. Chaplin said the recovery won't be complete until vaccinations are widespread, blah, 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 to make sure people are comfortable. That isn't the problem, I don't believe. It's a much deeper problem that's going on. And it certainly has added to it, but it is a much deeper, deeper problem. So anyway, what else is there about the global debt, Dave?
That's really it. I mean, there's some talk about about poverty reduction now has been stalled, that there are still a number of small businesses, and this is primarily in Asia now. They're talking about coming out of the Asian Development Bank that are struggling more than others. Bruce Gosper, who's a VP at the Asian Bank, also pointed out that there's a new poor that's emerging, mostly in urban areas, since agriculture has fared relatively better in the pandemic. Now, the Asian bank supposedly is focused on supporting informal workers who make up about two-thirds of the labor market in the economies the bank covers, and not surprisingly, are disproportionately women. Now, just real quickly on a not necessarily a related note, but almost breaking news of sorts that the average for the 30-year loan fell under 3%, 2.99, Freddie Mac reported today. And they attribute that to rising economic and financial market uncertainty. Of course, cheaper borrowing costs have fueled the housing rally during the pandemic. Last week, rates surged above 3% for the first time since June. The record low for 30-year loans came in January at 2.65. So still relatively remarkable at 2.999. We'll see what the coming week tells us about refinancings and mortgage applications and all that fun stuff, Melody.
Well, you know, the problem with, remember the overnight funding?
Yeah, the repo.
The repo markets. You know, that was due to rising rates on, you know, due to uncertainty. And, you know, people don't see this financial market uncertainty because the stock markets are higher. But it exists. And these are the little reactions that, you know, you see in the rates and like the repo market and things like that will have the big impact. So it'll be interesting to see. As far as I know, the Fed's still pumping money into the repo market. So,
yeah.
But hey, that doesn't matter. We're in a great shape. Yeah. We're in great shape, Dave. Doesn't everything make you feel all warm and fuzzy anymore? Jobless claims, they're down sharply.
I have a lot of gas right now, Melody. Excuse me, but that's how that makes me feel.
I was going to say, excuse me. I'm glad you were relating it to the wedding.
Absolutely.
Anyway, that you really don't.
We'll call it a metaphor.
Okay. All right. The number of Americans submitting jobless claims fell sharply last week from the Labor Department. The initial filings for unemployment benefits totaled 326,000 for the week ending October 2nd. That's below the 345 Dow Jones estimate and a little bit of a drop from the 364,000 from the previous week. Numbers come at a time when most of these pandemic-related programs that extended unemployment benefits have ended or are winding down. So, gee, Dave, is that the case? You take away the free money and people have to go back to work?
Well, that was the one of the biggest questions you and I have been asking. Whether this continues, certainly we'll know on a week-by-week basis, but the first indication is that, well, you know, money is an important factor in people's lives. So when you run out of one source, perhaps it's back to the shop.
As well we should, but
yes,
makes everybody feel better. You feel good. It's good for you. It's healthy for you. And so what else is in there, Dave?
Well, you know, they talk about continuing claims, which, you know, are those that are extend beyond the normal state benefits of 13, sometimes 26 weeks. They also posted a healthy decline, dropping almost 100,000 down to 2 million. Now, notable change occurred in those receiving benefits under all unemployment programs. That total dropped by 855,000. And again, almost all, not surprisingly, came from pandemic-related programs and extended benefits. There are now less than 4.2 million workers getting benefits. That's down from 5 million the previous week and 24.6 million 1 year ago, Melody.
Hmm. Well, you know, South Dakota, it's one place I haven't been. I would love to go. I would love to visit the Dakotas. And it's been reported recently that the state of Dakota has become the world's foremost tax haven.
This is fascinating.
Kind of right up there with the Cayman Islands. And even Switzerland. I don't. But anyway, of course, that's one of the clear messages from the Pandora's Papers, a recent leak of confidential financial information about the world's richest individuals. Hundreds of billions of dollars hidden in South Dakota trusts generate no taxes and are effectively off limits to anybody who might have a legitimate claim on them. Here's how it works. Like most tax havens, South Dakota has no income tax, no inheritance tax, and no capital gains tax. I'm moving there. But the state has gone even further than that. South Dakota allows for extreme secrecy when law enforcement comes knocking and protects assets from being claimed by creditors, ex-spouses, or pretty much anybody else. By setting up a trust, the settlor thinks some billionaire wanting to keep his assets secure gives those assets to a trustee in South Dakota to look after. The trustee then invests the assets for a beneficiary who is often a direct relative of the settlor. Neither the settlor nor the beneficiary ever needs to set foot in South Dakota or even be able all three parties, the settlor, the trustee, and the beneficiary can legally claim that the money isn't theirs, Dave.
Yeah, this is fascinating. You know, South Dakota started carving out its position as the most laissez-faire state for financial services in 1981 when it abolished upper limits for credit card interest rates. I'm surprised that there's many corporations incorporating their headquarters in Delaware given this. But some apparently have shifted from Delaware to South Dakota. In 1983, the state became the first to allow perpetual trusts. That's money that can literally remain untouchable for centuries with no one ever paying any taxes, inheritance taxes, on the principal or interest. Since then, South Dakota has continued to pass laws making its trusts more attractive to the world's ultra wealthy. It's also very secretive. It's virtually impossible to know who might have one in the state because all the related records are sealed. That is, documents setting up trusts. Now you got people like Ecuador's president, Chinese billionaires, dozens of other foreigners and Americans apparently sheltering their assets in the state where we will soon find Melody Cedarstrom's face. On Mount Rushmore.
There we go. What we're also going to see is a break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Please make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Heading into the second break right now, we're going to talk, another big topic that we've been talking about for at least a year and a half is supply and demand and supply channels and all those kinds of things. And Dave, I think that's what your levity is golden this week. It's about beer.
Supply and demand.
And demand.
Yeah, an interesting twist, relevant for our times. There's a new executive MBA class at MIT's elite Sloan School of Management. It's an exercise in systems theory. Yay. That Professor John Sturman puts his students through on one day of their 20-month program, actually on the first day of the class. It's probably never more relevant than what's been happening in the real world over the past 18 months. The so-called beer game simulates supply and demand across the industry, the brewery, distributor, wholesaler, and retailer. Students are divided into teams to play one of the four roles with the goal of keeping inventory streamlined and costs as low as possible. It was originally called the refrigerator game, but that didn't sell as well with college students. The beer has them apparently more engaged. When time was called 3 hours later after day one, the final scores were a surprise to the players, but not the professor who's been refereeing it and keeping score for four decades. After the class in late September was finished, the students, who are mostly mid-career professionals, ranging from doctors to food and beverage industry executives, shared their thoughts about what they learned. Here are some of their fascinating and insightful responses. One said, I was a bit surprised as to how quickly members of a team turned on one another, blaming each other and the customer so quickly instead of taking responsibility for their own inventory issues. This has certainly taught me to look in the mirror more when there are issues instead of being quick to blame others. Yeah, it's a real good lesson. Another observed Melody, accountability for one's actions is a starting point to understanding the downfall of supply chains during the pandemic. If one accepts his actions, they can foster an environment and spirit of inquiry with open communication across all domains, in turn building mutual reciprocity. Well, there you go. And another who says our ability to react to the data and information and how to get it amplified through the layers or hierarchy of an organization, oftentimes resulting in unintended consequences. Makes a lot more sense to understand what we are going through with supply chain constraints. It's a ripple effect that's playing out with a blast radius being the entire world, given how interrelated the supply chain ecosystem is. And this, once the thin and fragile layer of trust is perceptually breached, we quickly try to act and create certainty for ourselves, and in turn, often and accidentally, perhaps creating even more uncertainty for others. Once others then see our decisions, they likewise want to create certainty for themselves, leading to a bullwhip effect of misalignment, resulting in excess or drought. And finally, Melody, this. The pandemic has amplified failures which have always existed. But as with all failures, it represents an opportunity for innovation. That removes the negative human errors and behaviors. Well, let's hope these lessons can be applied to the real world. Get things rolling around the world again. Get those ports clear. Get inventory stocked up again. And perhaps by the holidays in 2023 or 2024, we might see things getting to this new normal. Melody, that is this week's Levity is Golden.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, which Christmas, 2025?
Gosh, I know.
I can't even imagine what will be going on by 2025. I don't think it's going to be status quo as we see it today, but
a lot's
going to happen.
Yeah, but then there may be five platinum coins in our reality.
Five?
$1 billion
platinum. 30? 30. Although I have a thought.
What?
The percentage that they plan of using, what would that percentage be? The 1 trillion to 30 trillion. You know, so that's a percentage that they must feel they have to back the debt. So you could kind of relate that to an overall thing, whether it be platinum or gold.
Well, that's an interesting that's a very interesting suggestion. That's something that's really food for thought.
Because they really couldn't come out and say, "Well, we're going to back it by gold." They can't do that.
Well, no, there's too much. I mean, even though Nixon essentially completed the demise of the standard in 71, it's, on the one hand, it's 50 years ago. On the other, it's still very raw. I just read a very interesting article in an academic journal today, a little above my pay grade, but the parts that I think I understood talked about that concept, and namely that a lot of conventional thinking today in mainstream media and politics, et cetera, is based on what the author characterizes as gold standard thinking, which he suggested was kind of anachronistic. I haven't finished it yet, so I'm not quite sure where he's going. But it's what you raised in particular is food for thought.
Yeah, especially if we go back to if they have to use gold in the basket of currencies, which is what I believe, that's the only way they're going to be able to stabilize currencies, is they're going to have to put something in there to do so, something that's recognizable, something that has been used and accepted, and we know all these central banks and governments own gold. So to me, that is the stabilizer of these currencies in a basket. So maybe that is the percentage of, you know, we often wonder, I don't think it would be 100%. I didn't think it would be 100%. But I knew there'd be some percentage that they would have to throw in there. So
yeah.
So that's what I was kind of thinking. So anyway, let's go ahead and talk about the Fed. And, you know, again, they come out and talk about they're going to reduce its monthly bond purchases by the end of the year. So it has been weighing a little bit on the precious metal market, as we see gold holding around 1750. There is one investment firm out there who sees gold prices pushing through thousands of dollars higher in the long term. And again, Jefferies Group. So the gold remains the essential hedge. He sees an environment of low growth and higher inflation. This is going to continue to grow. And Jefferies said that their analysts at Jefferies said that their long-term forecast remains in place for gold to push to $5,500 an ounce. And I'm going to go back to my story in the interview with Duffy from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And this is probably 6 years ago. He says gold should have been trading at $5,000 at that time. 6 years ago, should have been between $5,000 and $6,000. Where would we be today? We would be at probably around 7,000. So these numbers are real. And, but the way they've done it is this has been derived by comparing the January 1980 peak gold price of $850 with the increase in U.S. nominal personal disposable income per capita. Since then, the gold price was then equivalent to 9.9% of U.S. disposable income per capita, which was $8,547. So the gold price is now around $1,757 or 3.2% of disposable income per capita of the $54,671, Dave.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure that out. I guess they're taking $54,671, 10% of that, 9.9% mm-hmm. of that, basically coming up with the $5,500. Well, you know, the firm remains bullish on gold as the Fed and other central banks around the world discover that it's easier to take on unorthodox monetary policies than it is to exit them. And we'll certainly find that out about our own Fed as early as some say next month. But at Jefferies, the long-term view there remains the same as it has been for many years. And I'm quoting now, G7 central banks, including most importantly the Fed, will not be able to exit from unconventional monetary policy in a benign manner. Instead, it will ultimately remain committed to ongoing central bank's balance sheet expansion in one form or another. Such policies will increasingly discredit those central banks which have pursued unconventional monetary policy, thus threatening the stability and indeed integrity of the current fiat paper money system. It's interesting perspective, something to think about. Now that gold seems to be in a holding period, a holding range in the mid-1700s, don't wait for it to explode upward. Get in, you know, if you shouldn't be looking at it as an investment per se anyway, certainly in terms of timing the markets. But other things being equal, you know, if you're going to get in or you're planning to buy more and you've got the extra cash, or particularly if you're you're overloaded in stocks, which many Americans are, just call Melody at 1-800-375-4188. We'll get you set up.
And, you know, you know, we often talk about, you know, people always ask me, how much gold and silver do I need to have? There's people out there who'll say 5%, 10%, maybe a few might even say 20%. But is that what you would insure your home for? Would you insure your home for 10%? 20%? Well, that's what you're doing. Gold is the insurance policy for your wealth. So you have to insure it accordingly. And there's a lot of predictions out there for silver. I can't tell you how many times I'm asked today, which is a better investment, gold and silver. They each have their own fundamentals. There's a reason why you buy each. And it is important to own both. And it is, and these are the things that you have to follow. And there's no guarantees in anything. The point is you're converting your fiat dollars into real money. Because the pressure and the inflation is what robs you of your purchasing power. I don't care how high the stock market goes. It could go to, you know, it's still robbing you of this inflation. And so it's very important. And speaking of inflation, I think this guy has had his, I don't even know why we're talking about him, Dave. He's, you know, he's disgusting. He's a felon, basically.
Five times
a felon. And he's trying to support his $31 million salary. And he says the board sets my compensation. They would actually be offended if there was a pay cut. And, of course, this is the answer from J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon. And he was being interviewed. Axios. Jim Vandehei. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, you know what, Dave, though? Did the interviewer, Vandehei, did he really even bring up felonies?
No, he didn't.
Of course not.
At least in the part that aired on HBO. I mean, if it did, I missed it. I watched it. You know, I'm sure there were other, particularly watchdogs like Pam and Russ Martins at Wall Street on Parade. You're looking for that one particular topic being brought up, and it's like, all right, there's only 5 minutes left. Now's the time. End with a bang. Nope, wasn't going there.
Nope, of course not. And it's not any different than, you know, anything else that these mainstream Axios is changing a little bit, but they're still pretty soft shoe when it comes to, you know, asking any tough questions of any one of their political beliefs. But we talk about jams. And, of course, there's been that oil spill out there in Los Angeles. And that's going to contribute to higher costs and delays and intermittent goods shortages all across the U.S. Now some are saying it could be blamed for California's biggest oil spill in 27 years. The official cause of the pipeline rupture that spilled as many as 3,000 barrels of crude oil off of the Orange into the ocean off of Orange County remains unconfirmed. Preliminary reports indicate that a ship anchor may have hooked the pipeline, tearing the metal open. About 4,000 feet of the pipeline had been moved 105 feet from its original position, and divers found a 13-inch split in the line that's likely the source of the release.
That's a lot of steel.
Yes, but could have it been done intentionally?
Ooh.
We'll be right back.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. HomeAlarmRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, Melody taking care of other business. This final segment, call her at 1-800-375-4188, 375-4188. I have an article in this week's American Survival newsletter. It asks, is a coin the answer to our debt ceiling dilemma? We alluded to it in the first segment of today's program, and a little bit in the second segment. So I'm just saying, if you don't know much or anything about it, just keep an open mind, because in some ways it's an open and shut issue. But I'll let you be the judge of that. Now, Congress managed to avert a recurring crisis last week as it passed another short-term appropriation bill that will keep the lights on in the hallowed halls of Washington through December 3rd. And that leaves members with the rest of what Hayes Brown calls the to-do list from hell, at the top of which is what to do about the debt ceiling long-term. Of all the potential catastrophes in the making, this one may be the most arbitrary and self-imposed. Almost nobody likes the debt ceiling. There are some who prefer to keep it around. We'll get to that in a minute. For one, it's burdensome. It has become a political nightmare, and it's been raised or suspended every time since it's been a problem since it was set into place in 1939. The debt ceiling, that is. Despite that, for the third time in 10 years, we're facing a situation where if it isn't lifted, the entire economy could implode for no good reason. Now, Hayes opines that faced with the problem this asinine, the country may require a solution. That's truly absurd. Well, as a reminder, the debt ceiling is the legal cap on how much debt the federal government can incur. Generally speaking, though, approaching this limit, not to mention breaching it, has consequences. Now, some view approaching the limit as good, others not so much. Practically speaking, it means the Treasury can't borrow any more money to pay for all the things that Congress has already appropriated funding for, most notably paying interest on government bonds previously issued. Economists are predicting the fiscal version of Dr. Peter Venkman's description in the original Ghostbusters movie of the apocalypse if that happens. Venkman said, human sacrifice, cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria. Well, slightly more serious note, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned she's just going to run out of extraordinary measures, mainly accounting gimmicks, to stave off unprecedented disaster. Democrats wanted to use the continuing resolution that it passed last Thursday to lift the debt ceiling, but Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said, no, no, no. And that leaves 11 days to figure out a longer-term solution. By longer term, I don't mean another 3 months or 6 months or even a year, but it's going to be subject to further discussion, debate, and I'm sure compromise. Now, I'm not talking about I won't call it shameless, but the so-called deal reached today between McConnell and Senate Leader Chuck Schumer to sort of increase the debt ceiling by, $500 billion roughly, gets him through December 3rd. But faced with a problem this ridiculous, the country may indeed require a ridiculous solution in turn. Now, a lot of people say the best choice is to get rid of the debt ceiling entirely. That's a move that Yellen endorses. Her boss, the Prez, hasn't personally weighed in. Or at the very least, Congress could restore the so-called Gephardt rule, named after former House Majority Leader Dick Gephardt of Missouri. Now, Dick's rule held that when a budget passes Congress, it shall be deemed to have authorized whatever borrowing is implied by that budget. Well, both seem unlikely in the near term, and that leaves, I think, three immediate options. First, Congress increases the debt ceiling. The most obvious answer, except Senate Republicans have promised not to provide the 10 votes to avoid a filibuster under regular Senate rules. Now, under budget reconciliation, it's possible to raise the debt ceiling with just Democrats' votes, but doing so would be time-consuming, they say, i.e. politically complicated, and it could wind up blowing up the president's agenda altogether. And I'm sure that's what the Republicans have in mind. McConnell certainly knows both of these things, and that's why he's holding his ground while also insisting a default won't happen. Now, secondly, Biden could invoke the 14th Amendment, which holds that the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law shall not be questioned. Under this scenario, the Treasury would borrow more money despite the debt ceiling because the Constitution says the public debt has to be paid one way or another. At least that's the interpretation of many observers. The problem with that, Hayes says, is it's really a bad look to deliberately break the law, especially when it comes to Congress's power of the purse. President shouldn't be able to unilaterally set spending policy because, well, that's basically a monarchy. Since a constitutional crisis is virtually nobody's idea of a good time, except for maybe constitutional scholars working on the meter to tell us why such a crisis isn't a good idea, that leads us to option three. And Hayes calls it absolutely the most bonkers of them all, but the one most likely to succeed if push comes to shove. Treasury mints $1 or more trillion platinum coins. Now, thanks to a bizarre loophole in the nation's coinage laws, the Treasury Secretary is permitted to mint platinum coins in literally any denomination they want. Historically, those laws have been used to produce commemorative coins that are worth more than they cost the U.S. Mint to produce, thus netting a small profit for the government from coin investors. But in 2011 and 2013, Obama officials started wondering whether the laws could be used to solve the debt ceiling dilemma. Now, here's how pundits say it would work, and it does seem straight, you know, fairly straightforward. Yellen would order the U.S. Mint to strike one or more platinum bullion coins, each worth $1 trillion, face value. She would then purchase $1, $2, $3 trillion, whatever, of debt from the Fed and retire that debt with the coins, thus creating new breathing room under the debt ceiling. Now, that's according to Joe Wiesenthal, the executive editor of Bloomberg News, and a major debt coin advocate. Now, when the Obama administration considered this idea in 2013, it simply rejected it out of hand as both legally shaky and imprudent. But people like Harvard law professor Lawrence Tribe and former U.S. Mint director Philip Deal say the platinum coin option totally could work, at least legally. So far, the Biden administration has yet to really acknowledge that anything other than Congress's raising the ceiling will happen, but it could be time for the White House to start considering it if they're not. I'm not saying I support this trillion-dollar coin, but if push comes to shove again, however you feel about politics, You do not want a default. I'm telling you, it would wreak havoc on everyone's pocketbooks. Investment, secure, financial security, retirement planning. And I'm not sure how long it would take to recover. Some say 10 years, some say a lot longer. I mean, and who knows? But there are three main arguments against the platinum coin today, and they deserve serious consideration. The first is that it would ignite a new round of inflation when households can hardly afford it. But it's probably unlikely because the coin would never enter general circulation. So it's not like households, businesses would have access and all of a sudden have this windfall. Where, you know, similar to, you know, just a pent-up demand driving prices up, especially in the face of constrained supplies because of all these logistical nightmares. The second is that there's just not enough time to figure out the logistics of manufacturing a coin, even if there's only one, two, or three of them, and getting through any legal challenges that would be inevitable in time to avoid a default. It doesn't make sense. Instead, Hayes says the biggest argument against it is that it's a really weird idea that lays bare just how much of our financial system is arbitrary and capricious. Because it is. Now, the risk in 2011 and 13 was triggered by Republican demands that Obama slash spending broadly or defund all of Obamacare. This time around, the White House and congressional D's refused to negotiate at all over the debt ceiling rise. And that's fine with the R's. I mean, they have no real belief that it will, you know, that they'll ever get Biden to give up on his economic agenda to win his votes. Instead, they're content to let the D's hang in the balance and then place the blame on them if there's a default. And there won't be. I'm still highly confident there won't be. It's all part of the theatrics. That's a whole new level of cynicism in any event, and that's saying something because there's been a lot of that on both sides of the aisle lately and for a long time. You can already picture the historic photo op. Janet Yellen handing the newly minted coin to Fed Chair Jerome Powell with all the major Wall Street characters cheering ironically in the background. Although, as a quick aside, I wonder if instead the ceremony would feature an NFL official tossing the coin in the air. On one side are the rich and famous Wall Streeters in football uniforms, you know, or menacingly facing the other side, a struggling family of five, say, in their everyday street clothes. Heads, Wall Streeter wins. Tail, Main Streeters lose. Well, again, after the Fed is given the debt coin, it would then credit Treasury's account with $1 trillion or whatever that wouldn't count toward the national debt. Look, the debt limit is not a sacred principle in the Constitution. It's simply a quirk in the law that was intended to make it easier for the government to borrow to pay for World War I. However you feel about Congress's spending and taxation, you have to agree that it's absurd that it now leads to these high-tension showdowns, you know, every year, every other year, sometimes more often. As disruptive as a government shutdown would have been, failing to increase the debt ceiling to pay for spending previously approved, well, that'd be another matter entirely. Government wouldn't be able to pay its bills, including military pay, Social Security checks, and most importantly, interest on government bonds. Interest rates would soar. That would crash the economy. This turned into a big game of chicken. I mean, certainly pulling a $1 trillion platinum coin or two out of his back pocket isn't an ideal income outcome for Biden or anybody. On the other hand, you got to ask, who among us can say it's not better than letting tens of millions of people go without Social Security or military paychecks or literally wrecking an already struggling economy on the rebound? The debt ceiling no longer serves a useful fiscal purpose. It's just an anachronistic political stick that risks triggering an unconstitutional and catastrophic default. On the one hand, a trillion-dollar coin could effectively take that stick out of politicians' hands, rendering them less capable, in theory anyway, of causing a disaster through inaction alone. On the other hand, the trillion-dollar coin would probably allow the government to spend money without barring it or raising it via taxes, i.e. with little or no consequence, and that could be another dangerous precedent to set. Well, just as best desperate times yield desperate measures, with mixed results and certainty and divisiveness, God knows where we go here. We want to avoid untried and untested ideas like mint the coin, especially in these volatile times. It's time for Congress, probably, to do away with the debt ceiling. Future Congresses would be less likely to teeter with our nation's financial security in this political fashion if abolition of the debt ceiling were to become the law of the land, especially with the future president of the opposite party, whichever parties are in control. Instead, let's let our elected representatives debate the pros and cons of spending and revenue proposals on their merits, with maybe the Gephardt rule back in full force, and let the resulting deficits, or God forbid, surpluses, fall where they may. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of today's program. Sorry for my long-windedness this third segment. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody will be back tomorrow with Butch. Also be on the lookout for our weekly blog. Thanks always to our engineer, Todd. I'm Dave Allen. On behalf of Melody, thanks for listening to Financial Survival. Have a good evening, and please be safe out there. Bye-bye.